You know, it's interesting. I recently switched back to taking physical notes for all my episodes. For close to the past year, I switched to taking my notes in my phone. But man, for me, there's just not that kind of same connection, you know. So like, if I take notes on my phone, then I'm just writing down arbitrary, straight to the point kind of ideas, which is fine. I think that I'll probably continue to use my notes to write down like ideas for new episodes or whatnot. But in terms of note taking, man, I realized that for me, nothing really matches writing physically, pen to paper. And the another cool thing here is that this podcast is it'll be 7 years old in October, which, holy shit, time flies. That one kind of snuck up on me. It doesn't feel like 7 years at all. It feels for me more like 3.5, maybe 4 if I stretch it. But it certainly doesn't feel like it's encroaching on 7. But I don't say that to as any kind of weird humble brag. I say that out of just sheer shock and surprise. So for those of you who have been here, thank you. For those of you who are new here, welcome. Hope you guys are having a good time. There's plenty of space. You can have a seat wherever you like. And the waiter will be with you shortly. But the reason I bring all this up here is because when I switched back to taking physical notes again, I grabbed one of the old notebooks that I have here. There's a few different little moleskin notebooks that I have that I used to take notes for the podcast. And so I grabbed the one that wasn't all the way full, and I just started back writing in it again. But along the way, you know, I just kind of had to flip through and look at some of my old notes for some previous episodes. And I got to say, man, it for me, it was kind of a funny trip, because what I realized what I do here is that when I take notes, it's not like I'm how do I put this? In the words of Forrest Gump, I'm not a very smart man. So when I take notes, I just do extremely shorthand. But also, these are just more like triggering code words that trigger a response in me that allows me to go on these rambling tirades about whatever it is that I had in mind. So like, I can fit an entire 3-paragraph short story about something into one sentence. For whatever reason, thankfully it works for me. I don't know if this shit works long term. Like, looking back at some of these notes, I gotta be honest, I have no idea what the fuck some of this shit means. But man, it's a trip to read through. But I was flipping through and I landed on, I guess this one had to have been maybe from 2 or 3 years ago. I'm assuming this was a Valentine's Day episode. It was about the best and worst superhero couples. And I vaguely remember doing this episode. I think it was me and Kevin. But I had like 16 different superhero couples written down in 2 separate columns. Like, ones that I think were good and other ones that I think were just straight up toxic or ass or just shouldn't exist. And while I'm not going to like go through like this entire list and break it down, because clearly I've already done this a couple years ago, I would like to go back and revisit some of these to see what the fuck my thoughts were for some of these superhero couples. The very first one I have on here was Bucky Barnes, Winter Soldier, and Black Widow. And I had them in the good category. They worked for me. I thought they were a very, very good couple. I do remember reading them in Ed Brubaker's Captain America run. That's really where their relationship took off, where it began, took off, and tragically ended. And it does have a tragic ending, but that was a great couple. Batman and Catwoman, I put them in the bad category, and that's probably due primarily to Tom King's shitty Batman run, and he just kind of ruined any idea I had of those two ever working it out. Number 3 is a spoiler for Invincible, so I'm not going to talk about that one. The 4th one I had, Deathstroke and Terra. Do you guys remember Terra? She was in the Teen Titans cartoon, as well as obviously the comic books. But yeah, in the cartoon, they were smart enough to not put those two in like any kind of romantic relationship because Deathstroke is literally old enough to be her goddamn dad. But yeah, they were a straight up couple in the comic books. This teenage girl and this 40, 50 year old dude. I mean, yeah. And for my notes for that one, I just have written down wrong, wrong, wrong. And yeah, that shit was awful. This one was weird. I didn't have this in like the good or bad category. It has an asterisk next to it. Jean Grey and Scott Summers. I have written next to it, this is a fucking fiasco. And it is. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's not really too much more I can say on that one other than... down here in the notes, I have written down Scott and Emma all day. Because I have always preferred Scott with Emma than with Jean, if I'm being honest. When Jean is written well, she's great. And when she's not, like, why are you here, lady? Reed Richards and Sue Storm, Marvel's OG couple. How could you not like Reed and Sue? As a matter of fact, during the original Civil War comic book, it hurt my feelings that those two saw things differently, but it absolutely made sense that those two would not see things idealistically the same. Black Canary and Green Arrow. That one works. I have written down two imperfect people trying to make it work, and I think that probably best describes their relationship better than anything, man. They have such a great bond and relationship. I really love those two together in the comic books. To me, they're kind of the antithesis to Jean Grey and Scott Summers, you know, where like Jean and Scott are also always trying to make it work, but yet it never really does. But with Dina Lance and Oliver Queen, it always kind of works for those two. Kitty Pryde and Peter Rasputin, aka Colossus. Kitty and Colossus. I probably should have put an asterisk next to this one. I ended up putting it in the good pile. I think that those two are always, they're an adorable couple, but the weird thing here, okay, about their dynamic is that in the beginning when Kitty was flirting heavy with Peter, and Peter, to his credit, he would just damn near run the other way whenever Kitty would approach him with her advances. And, you know, Peter was in his 20s and Kitty was like 16. Like what the fuck is up with the creepy shit? But I don't know. That was, not everything Claremont wrote was golden. All right. There were some things that were just off. Kate Kane, a.k.a. Batwoman, and Renee Montoya. I really love that their relationship. As a matter of fact, I'm not even sure what they're doing with Renee Montoya in DC Comics. I need DC to get their shit together and do something with that character. She had a great stretch of comics there in like the mid 2000s. She was on fire, and her and Batwoman together were really such a they felt like a really kind of cool power couple, you know. And they didn't work, unfortunately, but that's kind of how it is if you're like a bat person. Your relationships are just doomed to kind of fail. But that one upset me. I was hoping that they'd be put back together at some point. Nevertheless, it has not happened. But yeah, you know, maybe one day. Number 10, and I'll just I'll probably end it here on this one. Daredevil and Anyone. I have this in the bad pile. And for the notes section here, I have written down, his devilish dick game will curse you for life. I gotta be honest, I don't know where the fuck I was going with that. That probably meant, it had something probably to do with the fact that a lot of women that Daredevil get with either are killed or are like permanently traumatized to a degree where they can barely even function on their own anymore. Like, people who date Daredevil, those poor women don't end up well, typically. Black Widow may be the best one in terms of, like, trauma response and how she bounced back, you know. But most women who date Daredevil, that shit does not go well. So, yeah, don't fall for his devilish dick game. It will curse you for life. No, on second thought, I'm going to end here on this one. Thanos and Lady Death. Also, that one was, as you can imagine, in the bad pile. And I just have written down, pussy so good, you destroy half of all life for it. Damn, that's got to be some good pussy. I mean, I don't know how else to sum that one up. There's not too much I can add to that. I go back through some of these, especially like some of the episodes from the early days on the podcast, looking at some of these old notes here. And I gotta be honest, thankfully, because of everything that's going on and just ideas that organically pop up in my head, I'm not in any shortage of ideas, but some of this old shit might be worth revisiting. But we'll see. And the cool thing is, I can do that, and most of you will never notice. So if you think you hear me discuss an episode before that you think you may have heard, you haven't. It's all in your head, all right? It is all in your head. But we're not here to talk about superhero couples. Not directly, anyway. We're here to talk about the commandments. But not just any commandments. We're here to talk about the important ones. We're here to talk about the superhero homie commandments. And this time, we're here to talk about superhero homie commandment number 2, which is hold true to the story. This one doesn't get talked about as much, but it should, because we've all seen superhero movies or have read superhero comic books that, how do I put this nicely, suck ass. And if the story has simply been improved upon, then things could have and would have been much better. Yet sometimes they weren't, and thus the existence of this commandment. You know, I was thinking when I was taking my notes about this commandment, and it got me thinking about a show that used to have the world in a vice grip just a few years ago, The Walking Dead. I don't know how many of you remember just how big The Walking Dead was. I mean, you should. It was just a few years ago. But there was a time when The Walking Dead would casually draw in 10 million plus viewers a week. And I mean, that's insane. Like, those numbers are just ridiculous. And it was doing it in an age where TV shows just typically weren't doing those kinds of numbers anymore. It wasn't like it was in the 90s when, you know, in the 90s, it was more common for hit TV shows to do those kind of numbers. But man, in the, you know, 2010s, that wasn't really the jive, because streaming was making a really big move and, you know, people just weren't watching cable television like that anymore. And there was, you know, and not even prestige shows like Walking Dead, like Breaking Bad, which is also an AMC show. It was doing tremendous numbers, but admittedly not numbers quite like Walking Dead in its prime. And during that time frame, Game of Thrones hadn't quite hit its stride yet, but we know it would eventually. But the reason I bring up The Walking Dead is because my parents were actually really big fans of that show. Really big fans. And then I was too for a while. I mean, clearly a lot of people were. And I had actually read quite a bit of the comic books. The homie Kevin had read more of The Walking Dead comics than I had. And so he knew more about that world and about things that happened than I did. But I read a good bit as well. And what was interesting is that we get to the season where they finally introduce Negan. And I had read that much. And so I knew about Negan, and I knew about Lucille, his bat, and I knew about the fate that Glenn, fan favorite character, would meet at the nail-spiked end of Lucille. And Glenn was not only a fan favorite character in the comic book, he was a fan favorite in the TV show. People really loved Steven Yeun's performance and the charm and charisma that he brought to the character. And I remember as that show was, really hitting the stride and seeing that they were going to bring in Negan, I just remember wondering, I remember just thinking to myself, I wonder what the casual audience is going to think of this whole Negan deal, because he has a very, very big and memorable introduction. And I also remember wondering, and maybe even discussing with Kevin and others, I wonder if they even go through with it. Maybe they won't. They may kill a lesser character and let Glenn live. You know, from a TV executive perspective, I can understand the appeal of not killing off one of your major characters in lieu of killing off maybe a lesser lesser favorite, you know. But here's what I do like about what The Walking Dead did in the comic books for this whole Negan deal was, at that point in the comic books, to me, Robert Kirkman, the creator, he had pulled a Robert Kirkman, which is things become kind of stagnant for a while. Not that things are ever disinteresting, but things are just stagnant. And, you know, admittedly, I think this even happens in the Invincible comic books. Things never get boring, but sometimes things get kind of stagnant where it's like, okay, things are happening, but nothing is really happening. You know, if that makes any sense to you guys, it's like the story is progressing, but man, my interest is kind of plateaued in what's going on. And the interesting thing about Robert Kirkman's writing style is that it seems like he understands that he's hit a creative plateau the same time that the readers do. And so his response is always to do something that is just over the top, sometimes maybe overblown, and just this huge thing to shake up the world, to shake up the characters in the story, and to get you reinvested in the story he's trying to tell. And admittedly, more times than not with Kirkman, it works, at least for a little bit. It's kind of like taking a shot of adrenaline, right? Like you're fucking tired or you're unconscious and you get hit with that fucking adrenaline and you are up and awake and aware. That's kind of what he does here. He does it, again, several times with Invincible. Even if you've just seen the Invincible TV show, you can probably pinpoint some of those moments. But it's not just in the Invincible comics. It was also here in The Walking Dead. And with The Walking Dead, you know, up until like the Negan point, things had been fine. But man, I was kind of growing a little bored with the going ons in The Walking Dead. But then we get to the Negan point and seeing, you know, Glenn get bludgeoned to death. And would that be bludgeoning damage or piercing damage? Because that bat had nails in it, right? So both. Being bludgeoned and pierced to death, you know, and with the whole eyeball popping, and just it was grotesque and revolting and holy shit. And for the most part, the way that readers reacted to that, because I didn't read it as it was coming out initially, you know, I read it after it had come out and it was being released in like compendium formats and whatnot. But the general consensus, it seems, from readers who read it at the time that it was being released was that, man, this comic book really made a bold decision. Robert Kirkman really made a very bold choice, and it paid off. Because while readers lamented the death of Glenn, who was a fan favorite character, to them, it made them excited about The Walking Dead again, because now they have this new, cool villain to hate and to see how Rick and the gang are going to deal with him. And it also made people feel like there was no plot armor. And I think as a fictional writer of this kind of content, that is, I think that's a great, great fucking mark. If you can convince your readers that there is no plot armor, that at any time anyone can go, if you can make your readers think that, that is power right there, because there is plot armor. There is. It may not be every character, but trust and believe, there are at least a handful of characters that have plot armor. And of course, this is just speaking generally, but still, the rule applies. And so Robert Kirkman, he had pulled the trick off. He made people think that plot armor wasn't real. You know, Rick had gotten his hand cut off, which Robert Kirkman later said he wish he hadn't done that. He regretted that decision because it limited everything he could do with the character, which, yeah, not a great call, I guess. I don't know. But there were just there were things he would do to kind of keep that enthusiasm alive. But and the whole Glenn thing was a very big and bold move, and it worked. It worked in the comic books. How did it work live action? Where am I going with this whole story here, right? So live action in the TV show, I don't remember exactly where they were in the season. Like, I don't remember if they ended the season with this. I don't remember if they started the season with this. But I can tell you this much. It probably wasn't placed well, because this probably should have been placed towards the middle half of the season and maybe not at the end. I believe they put this at the very end of their season, which you don't want to leave people time to stew and think about shit like this, because then they're just going to get upset. You know, people don't get to see what happens next immediately when something like this happens. It can backfire. But anyways, the reaction that people had to the Glenn death in the live action TV show was very visceral. And I remember it put my parents off, particularly my mother. She really did not like the Glenn death. And also, I have to, again, give kudos to the TV show, because they tried to pull a fake out. They killed Abraham as well. They killed him first, I believe, and then they killed Glenn. So they killed Abraham as almost like a security blanket for those who had read the comics and knew what was going to happen, to make us think that, oh, okay, instead of Glenn getting Lucille, it's going to be Abraham. Okay, you know what? It's the safe move to do, but I understand why you would do that. And then, no, they turn around and kill Glenn as well. Very, very smart move for them to do. The reason why I point this out is because I think that was the point where my mother in particular had lost interest in the show. A lot of people will lose interest in the show, not due to this, but due to just the declining quality of The Walking Dead. But the casual fan base as a whole had a very visceral reaction. And you can tell that the showrunners and that the executives at AMC didn't really know how to respond to this. And I think at that point they were on like their mid-season break or some shit. So they had time to kind of mull it over. But the response from the fan base was very mixed and divided. You had the comic book fans on the forums talking about how this is a really good thing. You know, like this, you know, reinvigorates the show. No one's safe. And now we have Negan, this big bad threat. I mean, and it's a double-edged sword, because what's the point? How can you have a powerful villain if he is neutered and can't do anything? But do you really want to run the risk of angering your fan base by getting rid of characters that they love? And, you know, if you're any kind of fictional creator, you're going to have to find ways to deal with that. And I think that ultimately, them holding true to the story in this regard really paid off. Because here I am talking about it some 8 years later, you know, or however long it's been. And so we know how The Walking Dead would go after that. You know, they would try to maintain that level of popularity. But I think that they were scared off by the response to the Glenn death. And I think that did play a role in the decline in quality of that show. That, amongst other things, led to that decline of quality in that show. But just seeing how the showrunners and the execs, they were met with the decision. This is where we're at now in the Walking Dead mythos. And this is where we are with the story. It's time to bring in Negan. And when Negan is introduced, he does this to this character. And they stuck to their guns and they did the damn thing. You're not going to win over everybody. And there is no way to make everyone happy. Think about it again. 10 million people on average viewing that show at one point. You're not going to make 10 million people happy. And with something like that taking place, you know, with a killing like that of a fan favorite character, there's going to be some divide. And I think that they ultimately made the right decision. They decided to hold true to the story, and in doing so, they gave us at least, if nothing else, a great introduction and a great moment to what is definitely one of the more interesting villains that I've ever read in the comic books that I think was very well translated to the silver screen. Shout out to Jeffrey Dean Morgan. So with that being said, we can finally get into things properly. But first, I do believe 26 minutes in, an introduction is in order. Homies one and all, welcome back to another very special episode of the Superhero Homies Podcast. My name is Quentin, and here I am, lying to you guys again, saying that this will be a shorty episode. But I'm going to do my damnedest to make sure that it is. This is just one commandment we're talking about here tonight, holding true to the story. There's no reason to keep us here all night. Come on, it's like the weekend. You young kids or whatever, you guys have shit to do. So listen to the podcast and do your laundry or taxes or whatever it is you got to do and have a good time. This is a very important commandment. I think that they're all very important. But, you know, when it comes to holding true to the story, it's kind of important to understand that this is something that means a couple of different things. And throughout this episode, I'm going to discuss with you guys what this means from the various different angles. All right, so first of all, let's talk about it from one angle here. So basically, if a film is based on a comic book story, it is up to the people who are making or adapting the movie or TV show to understand and properly display the true meaning of that comic book. So what does that mean? I think that when I say that, a lot of you may assume that what I mean is if a movie is based off of The Watchmen, for example, then you expect The Watchmen comic book brought to the big screen. Well, yes, but also no. So The Watchmen is a good example of holding true to the story because it literally holds the comic book. You know, with the one big glaring difference of Dr. Manhattan instead of the fabricated squid monster, the Watchmen, especially the ultimate cut, the director's cut, really does probably the most accurate attempt that we'll ever see of a one-to-one adaptation of a comic book to the big screen. And I think that is very important, and that it was a very fucking daring thing to do, a very lofty goal. But I think that for the most part, I think that Zack Snyder landed that one. But here's what we have to remember, and here's why I don't think that this rule does not apply to every single comic book adaptation, and that's this: The Watchmen, as it is written by Alan Moore, is a self-contained 12-issue story. Nothing more, nothing less. And while 12 issues is a lot to fit into a film, it can be done. And for the most part, it was. Now, if you look at something like the MCU, or even the DCEU for that matter, they are telling, or trying to tell, an overarching story. And so along the way, in their own overarching story, they're going to try to adapt stories from the comic books. Therefore, it is impossible to, from page to screen, adapt panel for panel those same comic books. It just doesn't work. Logistically speaking, it does not work. Case in point, Civil War. While I do have my own problems with Civil War, I don't have the same problems that some other comic book nerds have. I know some nerds personally who dislike the Civil War movies simply because, I shouldn't say simply, I don't want to reduce their argument, but they dislike the Civil War movie because in the comic books, Civil War is very big and boisterous, and it feels like, no pun intended, but it feels like a heavy gut punch. You have all of these heroes who have chosen side. I mean, you've got the Fantastic Four, you've got Daredevil, you got Luke Cage, you have the X-Men, you got Spider-Man. I mean, you have all of the Avengers, but you have all of these heroes who have split into factions and chosen sides, and it feels like the entire Marvel Universe, or at least the Marvel Universe in terms of planet Earth, that they're all warring with one another. And so it feels very big and very grand. And a lot of the comic book nerds, and again, even some of the ones that I know, are they don't like the Civil War movie because it doesn't display that level of hero versus heroes. You know, we don't see whole battlefields clogged with, you know, we don't see panels of heroes fighting other heroes. You know, we don't see the Ragnarok, that was the robotic clone of Thor that malfunctioned and killed Bill Foster. You know, the thing that was made by, who was it, Reed Richards and Hank Pym. Yeah, they made that fucking scary-ass killer Thor clone thing. But, you know, you don't get that in the Civil War movie. I never had a problem with the Civil War movie not doing that, because how could they? You know, it's a logistical impossibility. Like, they literally could not do all of that in the movie. Even if they somehow had all of the rights to those characters, it's going to do some of the characters an injustice to kind of try to put them in and make them palatable to the audience. And again, I think general rule of thumb, 70% of the audience is going to be casual, and they may not know who these characters are without proper introductions. So you can't just throw every single character that was in the Civil War comic book into the Civil War movie and expect it to land. And that's why Kevin and I devised this commandment of holding true to the story. It's not about adapting everything exactly panel for panel, unless you can. But in most cases, we understand that you just physically, literally cannot. And so what holding true to the story means in every case is understanding what the story is supposed to be about and making sure that the core meaning and message of that comic book makes it into the movie. So for example here, let's deviate from Civil War for a little bit. We might circle back around to it later on, but let's look at the movie Logan, for example. One of my favorite comic book movies. I love that movie. It was at Comic-Con, I think 2016. Hugh Jackman, and I believe James Mangold was there as well, the director. Hugh Jackman stood up and said, "I have three words for you. Old Man Logan." And the place went crazy. Old Man Logan is a very kind of a prolific, iconic comic book written by Mark Miller. And it's, you know, very dystopian, and it's a very gritty story. And, I mean, it's full of just despair and anguish. And, I mean, there's a lot of dark shit going on in that book. And people were very excited because they were expecting, oh, shit, we're going to see Old Man Logan. And I remember seeing a clip of Hugh Jackman say that. And I remember also thinking to myself, how are they going to do that? Because to do Old Man Logan, you might be able to replace some other characters, but you're going to need the Hulk, because you're going to need Maestro. You know, the evil future incarnation of the Hulk. You're going to need that character. And obviously, Fox didn't have the rights to use the Hulk. So I was wondering, how are they going to play this off then? And then you see the Logan movie, and the most purist of purists would say that they don't like it because it is not a faithful adaptation of the comic book Old Man Logan. And my response to that is this, I mean, they are correct on a technical basis. In terms of plot similarities, there's not a whole lot of connection there, right? It does not have the Hulk family in it in terms of like his inbred children. It doesn't have Maestro in it. There's no Old Man Hawkeye. You know, there's no, you know, they're missing a lot of that components. Wolverine doesn't have a new wife who was murdered by this Hulk gang. You know, so we don't get that in this movie. But what we do get is this still slightly futuristic version where Logan, he may be surrounded by people, but for all intents and purposes, he is still very much alone and he is hopeless. And that same personality has transferred over from the comic book to the movie. The tone of the Old Man Logan comic book is very much alive in the movie Logan. And it's the tone and it's the anguish of the characters and the dire situation of the story. All of that is still taken over from the comic book and placed very well into the movie. So on a thematic standpoint and from a tonal standpoint and from a character standpoint, in terms of how the characters are used and how the characters are feeling and how the characters are behaving, the movie is actually a very, very good adaptation of Old Man Logan comic book. Now, again, in terms of story, yeah, if you want to be mad at the movie because it does not adapt that story, then you have every right to be. Hugh Jackman did get up there and say three words, Old Man Logan. And then, you know, you go watch the movie and you're like, hey, I read the comic book. This is nothing like the comic book, except it kind of is. They did tell their own story, but at the same time, the movie Logan is less of an adaptation and more of an homage to the comic book. And with as good of a homage as that is, I think it gets it. So what is the meaning of the comic book Old Man Logan? What is the message behind that? And does the movie Logan, does it adapt that? Absolutely. Because it's about Logan in a world of despair, experiencing greater hurt and loneliness than he ever has, but yet seeking revenge one last time because he needs that. Like he wants to put away that old Logan, but damn it, life just won't let him. And so now for one last time, he's got to do this shit. And maybe, just maybe, at the end of that road, there'll be some kind of light, some kind of hope there waiting for him. And I think that the movie does a beautiful job of adapting that. So, I mean, if you want to put an asterisk next to it, I understand. But again, I think that it is a beautiful homage to the comic book. We can juxtapose that with a more recent movie, The Flash. And boy, there's not a whole lot I have to say on this just because, you know, me and the homies, we did a whole review on this last year. And then shortly thereafter, I did a 2-part episode reviewing the Flashpoint story. So, you know, there's not a whole lot more that I can add to that dialogue versus what has already been recorded and posted here on this podcast. So definitely check those out for more in-depth analysis of where the Flash movie went wrong. But essentially, the Flash movie, it understood the comic book. It understood the basis of what the Flashpoint story should be or was supposed to be. Where they failed at, though. Okay, so first of all, I got to be honest. There are things that the Flash movie does that it doesn't entirely fuck up. There are key moments for sure that are missing. But what about the messaging of the Flash movie? I mean, listen, it doesn't do it greatly, but there is some things in that movie that at least lets you know, hey, these motherfuckers, I guess, did read the comic books. At the end of the day, it's about the why. Like, why is Flash doing this? Why is Flash fucking with the timeline? He's doing it for his mom. And as bare bones as that is, the movie at least gets that much right. He does it for his mom. And when he has to say goodbye to his mom, in my humble opinion, I actually think that that scene may be just as touching as it is in the comics. Again, wildly different situation. You know, he's not in the grocery store in the comic book. He goes back and he reveals himself to his mom and he explains the whole situation and then they have their tearful goodbye. But the scene in the movie where, you know, he's just a stranger to his mom and having to say goodbye that way, I also thought was very touching. There's not too much more about the movie that I thought they did very well with at all. I mean, honestly, for that movie to be a true adaptation or to even pull an Old Man Logan comparison to that and to pay homage to its comic book predecessor, it would have needed to have more of the heart of the comic book inserted into that movie. Meaning that if you're not going to use characters like Thomas Wayne, okay, so they don't want to use Thomas Wayne, they want to use Michael Keaton's Batman, okay, you know what? While I don't agree with it, I understand. Nostalgia is in. People love Keaton's Batman. And people want to see him come back and put on the cape and cowl. The issue is this, right? They had him as Batman, Bruce Wayne, fine, whatever. And he goes through the motions of doing all the things that Thomas Wayne did in the comic books. That's also fine, of course. He's the one who helps Flash get his powers back. He's the one who's guiding Team Flash, you know, throughout this adventure and to take them where they need to be. The issue I have with that is, at the end of the day, if they wanted to give us another adaptation of Batman, that's fine, with Bruce Wayne, that is. But you've got to make him feel like Thomas Wayne. He's got to have some kind of the same ideals. Like, what does this Batman do differently? You know, for example, in the comic books, it's very clear that, oh shit, this Batman, this Flashpoint Batman, is very different from the one that Barry is used to. This motherfucker has guns, and he's hurting me, and he's very mean. It's somehow even meaner than the Batman that Barry's used to. But the movie, it felt like it was a soulless kind of attempt, half-hearted attempt. And the most frustrating thing about the Flash movie is that, unlike Logan, the Flash movie had all of the toys in the toy box to repeat everything that happened in the comic book. There's literally no reason why they could not have adapted the Flashpoint story panel for panel, page for page. They literally could have. The only difference would be is that they would have had to have given us a few extra scenes, a few extra moments with Eobard Thawne, a.k.a. Reverse Flash, who was not even in the movie. And again, like, I try not to hold that against the movie too much because there was no maestro in Old Man Logan or in the Logan movie. But at the same time, there could never be a Maestro in a Logan movie because Logan was obviously owned by Fox, and Hulk is technically owned by Legendary, being leased to Disney. It's a weird kind of conundrum they're in, but long story short, we're never going to see a Hulk in a Fox-led X-Men Marvel movie. That was just never going to happen. But with this Flash movie, they could have given us the Atlantis and what am I thinking of? Oh yeah, the Atlantis and Amazonian War. They could have given us that. I mean, I think that would have been great for Aquaman and for Wonder Woman. I would have loved to have seen Jason Momoa and Gal Gadot put in those kind of performances for those characters. That would have been amazing, I think. They did some things in the movie that I think were handled okay. Like, I don't think that the movie is like a complete irreprehensible like piece of garbage film, but man, do I think they dropped the ball on what could have and honestly should have been an easy A-plus movie, an easy layup, because the blueprint was right there and they could have adapted the whole thing damn near panel for panel, but they didn't. And the issue was this, man, and there's always this caveat: don't do it different unless you think you can do it better, you know. And they couldn't, and they didn't. But enough of shitting on the Flash movie. Have you guys ever seen a movie that starts good, but then it gets bad? You know, I think that we all have, right? We've all seen movies, or even for me, I've read comic books like that, that maybe start good, but end bad. The reason for that is because there's no real plot structure. And where there is no plot structure, the plot can just kind of meander and go wherever it wants to until you wind up someplace completely different from where you started. And now things make no sense. It's a terrible tragedy when that happens, because when you have a movie that starts good and ends bad, in my opinion, that's almost worse than the movie that starts bad and ends bad. Because if a movie starts bad and ends bad, well, I mean, it was bad all the way through. You never had any hope. But if it starts good and then ends bad, it means that some shit went wrong somewhere. Hell, I mean, I was just talking about Wolverine or Logan, the first Wolverine solo movie, X-Men Origins Wolverine. That movie starts really well. But then it kind of quickly goes off the rails. It's got like a really good first 15 minutes, though. I don't remember what year it was. I think it was the pandemic year, so like 2020. The homie Kevin and I did an episode called Wolverine-a-thon, so something like that. It's when we watched all three Wolverine solo movies and then reviewed them all in one mega podcast episode. And when we watched X-Men Origins, you know, because neither one of us had seen that movie in quite some time, we were like, oh shit, man, this movie starts off really good. I mean, even once we get to like adult Logan and he's with you know, the militaristic task force, and they're going through and they're trying to retrieve the adamantium, even that, all of that was really good. And it was crazy because it was like, who the fuck in the writing room was in there reading the comic books and taking notes of this shit? Because, like, yeah, that's essentially what Logan and team did. Sure, there was no Wade Wilson on the squad in the comic books for that little tirade, but so what, you know? The movie did, like, a very good job, though, of depicting, like, what that team did or the type of operations that they would do or perform. And even the members who were on the team, such as guys like John Wraith, Will.i.am's character, were there. Like, I mean, so yeah, they were. That movie was definitely starting in the right direction, and you know, obviously, the best bits of that movie were like the first 5 minutes were great, when you see little Logan, and you know, he's in the 1800s, and he's in bed sick, and little you know, little Jimmy, as he was called, you know, always sick, you know, never well. And then, you know, you get the whole opening with the death of his father and then the emergence of Wolverine's mutant abilities and whatnot. Like, all of that was also taken from comic books. There was a Wolverine miniseries that came out, I think, like a year before the movie came out. It was a situation similar to Batman 89, where they realized that they had no origin for the Joker, and so we got the Killing Joke that came out shortly before Batman 89, so that they could kind of have some kind of basis for the Joker. And it was a similar situation here with X-Men Origins Logan, or Wolverine, I should say, because, yeah, they had hinted all around Logan's origin and whatnot, but there was nothing really pinned to paper to depict what his childhood was like, and so they released that Wolverine miniseries that came out maybe a year or so before the movie. But yeah, so the movie, actually, if I could be so bold, I would say it doesn't really go off the rails for me until like the 20, maybe 25 minute mark. Is the movie stops being good right after Wolverine and Sabretooth have their first fight. It's when Wolverine's wife is supposedly killed, and Wolverine goes on a rampage looking for Sabretooth, and those two duke it out in a very entertaining fight. And Wolverine loses. Again, very comic accurate. Wolverine always is getting his ass whooped by Sabretooth, you know. Adamantium claws or not, it doesn't really matter, you know. It's a hard fight for Wolverine every time. But after that, I think that's when Wolverine goes to the Weapon X facility and says, hey, give me the Animantium so I can go and stop Victor. And yeah, that's when the movie goes off the rails and just never recovers. So, yeah, and you know, I wanted to bring that up just because, man, it goes to show that if they really had stuck to their guns, they could have stuck the landing and given us an excellent movie. So if you pause the movie right where I said, so you give us everything from sick Logan as a kid, having to flee from his home in the 1800s, to Logan and Victor, you know, seeing them fight in various wars and getting, I guess, court-martialed via execution, kind of, and seeing them team together for their, like, the Canadian Task Force and seeing them work together on those Black Ops missions. All that's great. So Wolverine retiring and living a lowly life with his wife, and you know, having her quote unquote get killed by Sabretooth just to draw out Logan. I think all of that is great. That movie was going one direction, and then something fucking strange happens. You can blame it on the writer's strike of 2008 if you want to. I do not. I think that this movie was probably going to go a similar direction no matter what, because it just goes completely off the rails. Like, it really feels like someone else started writing this movie after that. And I think that if they had just kind of stuck to the tone, to the feel of what they already had for that first 20 minutes, they could have given us something great. But instead, what we get is a mind-numbingly dumb action romp that gives us the worst adaptation of Deadpool that's ever even conceivable. And we get a lot of nonsensical, bad CG, fucking ridiculous-ass fight scenes. And for what? So, yeah, I think that that had they simply had an idea for how they wanted this movie to go, and had they stuck to their guns, had they really just held true to the story they wanted to tell, then things could have been a whole lot different for that movie. You know, I think about it like this, right? Like, if they, because the way that the movie was going and the way that they were telling that story, not to Monday morning quarterback this thing, you know, 17 years later or whatever. But honestly, the story there should have ended with Wolverine getting the Adamantium. you don't give the adamantium 25 minutes into the movie, because that really doesn't, because at that point, like, I mean, for one thing, yeah, it's lore breaking, you know, which is really bizarre, because the first 20 minutes of the movie tries really hard to stick to the convoluted lore of Wolverine, which I was oddly impressed with. And then they just decide to throw all of that out the window and just have this mindless action romp. If they didn't try to distract us with the oohs and ahs of the fights and explosions and bad CG, and really stuck to their guns with giving us an intelligent story, one that maybe begins or continues to perpetuate the cycle of violence that is Wolverine, I think that would have been a great story. You know, and that cycle of violence with Wolverine, it always goes with him finding love, losing that love, getting revenge, and then living alone. And if that movie wants to end with him in the Weapon X facility, being captured, being tortured, and being experimented on, and then you have Wolverine become that monster, I would always recommend you guys look at the Barry Windsor Smith Weapon X comic book. Fucking phenomenal comic book. That is like the Weapon X comic book. If you want to know what the experiments were like on Wolverine and what all happened, how he got the adamantium, that is always the story to go to. Phenomenal comic book. We covered that a few years ago as well. But if they wanted to end with that story where Wolverine is now the monster in the cage, I think that's amazing. But they didn't do that. Instead of giving us something that's more thought-provoking about the discussion of what is man versus monster, about where does grief end and violence begin, like instead of giving us something kind of deeper to think about, like the true meaning of Wolverine's whole story, instead of doing that, they gave us just another action movie that ends up being woefully forgettable. I was going to give some other examples, but I realized now we're about an hour in here. So instead, I want to end with this thing here, and that is Superhero Homie Commandments number 1 and 2 are uniquely linked. There's a few other commandments that are also linked, like 3 and 4, I think, are linked, but to a lesser degree than 1 and 2. 1 and 2, obviously, the character integrity and holding true to the story. Those two commandments are uniquely linked because if you have a good story and weak characters, then those weak characters will drag down the story, and now you no longer have a strong story. And vice versa. If you have strong characters and a weak story, then a weak plot will put your characters in positions where your characters have to make dumb decisions that they normally wouldn't, and that would thus bring down the story. Or the characters, I should say. So it's a lose-lose situation or a win-win situation. If you have good characters, you need a good story. If you have a good story, you're going to need some damn good characters to fill that story out. And so the two really do go hand in hand here. But, you know, the reason why it's such a unique scenario and such a unique difference between writing good characters and writing a good story is because to have a good story, you know, you need to have like your plot and your premise laid out, and your characters are the ones who are navigating the story. Now, what often happens that I think is kind of a travesty is that characters who are well-written have their own distinct mindsets and personalities and characteristics. We, as the audience or the readers, we know how these characters behave and how they react. Where a bad plot leaves good characters is we see those well-written characters do things that are dumb. You ever watch a movie and say, why did they do that? That's so stupid. What we really mean is that it's so stupid for that character to do, because we know they wouldn't do that. But they're doing it because the plot needs them to, in order for the plot to get to the next area. If your plot needs a character to do something that you know they wouldn't, then you need to rework that plot and figure out another way to get that character to where they need to be. So, yeah, Commandments 1 and 2 are very much uniquely linked, and they always will be. There's nothing, no way around that. But I think that that would be it for this shorty episode. It's still shorter than my normal episode, so I'm still going to call this a shorty. Superhero Homie Commandments number 2, hold true to the story. So, if you have the freedom of a Watchmen, which is a self-contained 12-issue story, then sure, go ahead and do your damnedest to give us that panel-for-panel breakdown. But more importantly, give us the meaning and integrity of that story. That is what's most important. A good point of that, and I'll leave on this note, I promise, is a story that we're probably going to review here in a couple weeks to celebrate the 10-year anniversary, Captain America Winter Soldier. Captain America Winter Soldier. If you guys read that comic book, it is very different from the movie, or I should say the movie is very different from the comic book, but where it matters the most, they are incredibly similar, and the movie does a great job of adapting all of the important things from that comic book. So the mindset of Captain America, the fact that he still feels like a man out of time, he is suffering from a type of depression in the comic books, actually. And the fact that in the movie, he feels like he's a man out of time, that he's all alone, even though he's surrounded by people. The mindset of Captain America isn't sharp. It is not what it needs to be. He's got to battle some things. We see that in both adaptations, in the comic book and in the movie. We see him relying on people when he knows he doesn't want to have to, but damn it, yeah, he'll take the help. He encounters, obviously, Bucky. You know, that's the biggest green flag here is, you know, us seeing Bucky being adapted in such a beautiful and wonderful fashion, such a horrific fashion in the way that he's utilized. And obviously the iconic line, "Who the hell is Bucky?" lifted straight from the pages. But listen, there's a lot more things that are taken from the Winter Soldier comic book and placed into the movie. And like I said, in a few weeks, the homie Caleb and I will be reviewing that. So that'll be a ton of fun. Don't have a set date yet, but I promise you guys it's going to be on the way. As well as a bunch of other fun episodes as well. We are doing the once a month, I don't know what we're going to call it, the homie club. I don't know what it is. But basically, that is going to be a thing where once a month, one of the four of us will pick a movie that is at least 25 years old, and we will watch it and then sit down here and review it. The homie Oz is up first. I think he picked some shitty movie, and I cannot wait to get that over with. That'd be fun. Of course, there would be the review of The Crow, the original 1994 movie, as well as the comic book that predates it. And obviously the Crow reboot when it comes out. So there's going to be a lot of crowing going on here. And Mistborn, for those of you Sanderson fans out there, there would be a Mistborn review. My reading of that has been going a lot more steady lately, now that my day job has started to calm down some. And so, yeah, if you guys have not, or if you guys are not familiar with that, it's a very, very fun and interesting fantasy book series here. I am just on the first one. My backlog of books to read is crazy, so it takes me a long time to get through anything. But it is fantastic so far. So the review of that will also be coming soon as well. Anyway, I have rambled long enough. Homies, you guys are great. If you guys have any kind of questions, comments, gifts, threats, food supplies for me, hit us up at superherohomies@gmail.com or any of the social media outlets. I promise you, I am always active, live, and listening. That will be all for now. I will see you guys again soon. But until then, my name is Superhero Homie Q. Till next time.